A string of recent films are casting prominent actresses in dark, creepy, and nasty characters. One example is the movie May December, which received 4 nominations for this past weekend's Golden Globe Awards.
Can I jump in?
Sure, please.
There are nothing but stereotypical roles for Hollywood actress. I think the structure of Hollywood narrative really thrives on stereotypes, and the sort of mild digressions are more interesting. So basically we have like the damsel in distress.
But a lot of it is absolutely explicit. Like, you know, he says to one girl when she walks in, I didn't recognize you with your clothes on, which is the kind of line that you could only get away with in pre-code Hollywood cinema. But there's this whole group of films where the women are desperate enough that they have to take chances with their virtue, as it would have been called in the early 1930s.
Yeah, the evil stepmother, the nymphomaniac, the single white female, the crazy ex-girlfriend, the other woman, any woman whose sexuality and desire and ambition poses a kind of inconvenience or conflict for the film's more normative protagonists, like the good girl, the girl next door, the good old boy, whoever. She's the woman, the bad woman is what stands kind of in conflict with the good protagonist getting exactly what they want. But she also spices things up. She creates kind of difference and tension that drives the narrative forward.
What defines the femme fatale is sexuality and intelligence. And that's why she's dangerous, because she knows that she has sexual power over men and has the intelligence to manipulate it. So a figure like Marilyn Monroe is, she had one femme fatale role, but it was just wrong for her in Niagara. Like the thing that's funny about Marilyn Monroe is that she doesn't know the discombobulating effect that she has on men. Like in The 7 Year Itch, she's like, or in Some Like It Hot, you know, she's just totally unaware of what her effect is. And so she doesn't know how to use it on.
Was there an audience for these films?
Was there? That's what, like, these films were made because that's what the audience demanded.
Deed, you know that before the movie industry moved out west and Hollywood established itself as the dream factory, the film industry was very experimental and so much more open to women in the wide range of creative characters they could take on, from good to bad. And women were also prominently engaged in the business of making films. Dozens and dozens of powerful women worked as directors in the early days of cinema. But those powerful women were gradually squeezed out of the movie industry, and women's acting roles became more restricted, more stereotyped, particularly after Hollywood gained substantial financial backing from Wall Street. Hey there, news peelers. Today is Wednesday, January 10, 2024. And this is Adele, your host at the History Behind News podcast. Aren't you tired of the repetitive news on TV and social media? They just go over the same dramatized developments all day long. Do you ever wonder what happened before our news? I mean, how do we get here? They say if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. So while others cover the news, I uncover its history. I call this peeling the history behind news, which we accomplish in weekly conversations with distinguished scholars who delve deep into history to give us their fascinating perspectives from our past. I'm committed to making in-depth history that are researched and written by scholars, enjoyable and accessible to everyone. So grab a cup of coffee or your favorite drink, or both, and let's get into it. I love the movies, but I'm not what you would call a movie buff. Regardless, when I spot a trend in the movies or something historic, I dig into it. For example, after French movie critics lambasted the recent movie Napoleon, played by Joaquin Phoenix, I decided to produce an episode about Napoleon, the man who was responsible for the deaths of 6 to 9 million people. My guest for that episode, which will air next week, is the director of the Institute on Napoleon and the French Revolution, so it should be a great conversation. As for the current episode, I was reading the Wall Street Journal a few weeks ago and stumbled upon an article with this headline, quote, "In Hollywood, it's the golden age of the creepy woman," unquote. Of course I read the article, and I've dropped a link to the article so you can read it too. This Wall Street Journal article explained how leading actresses are gravitating toward films with female characters with, quote, "sinister vibes and dark secrets," unquote. And the article gives the following film examples: Tar, a 2022 film starring Kate Blanchett; Eileen, a 2023 film starring Anne Hathaway; and May December, also a 2023 film with Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman. As I told you in the opening, this film was nominated for 4 Golden Globe Awards, which took place this past weekend on Sunday, January 7th, and drew 9.4 million viewers. The movie was nominated for Best Motion Picture. Natalie Portman was nominated for Best Performance by a Female Actor in a Motion Picture. Julianne Moore was nominated for Best Performance by a Female Actor in Supporting Role in any Motion Picture. Charles Melton was nominated for Best Performance by a Male Actor in a Supporting Role in any Motion Picture. Also, I recently noted that 2 New York Times movie critics are picking May December to be nominated by the Academy for the Best Picture category. The 96th Academy Awards is scheduled for March 10. The point is, this film, in which actresses play characters with sinister vibes and dark secrets, is doing pretty well. So, to better understand the history of women in cinema, not just in Hollywood, from their stereotypical roles to more creative and perhaps more liberating roles, I spoke with Professor Thomas Doherty and Professor Maggie Hennefelt, who essentially ran the program by asking each other wonderful questions that, frankly, I hadn't even thought about. Professor Doherty is a cultural historian with a special interest in Hollywood cinema. He's a professor of American Studies at Brandeis University who guest participated in our program last year. He's the author of many books, including the following: Pre-Code Hollywood, Sex and Morality, and Insurrection in American Cinema, 1930 to 1934, and also Hollywood Censor, Joseph I. Breen and the Production Code Administration. Professor Hennefelt is a MacKnight Presidential Fellow and Associate Professor of Cultural Studies and Comparative Literature at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. She's a curator of the 4-disc DVD Blu-ray collection titled Cinema's First Nasty Women. She's the author of many books, including the award-winning Specters of a Slapstick and Silent Film Comedienne. Her next book, expected in February, is titled Death by Laughter. To learn more about Professor Doherty and Professor Hennefelt, you can visit their academic homepages, the links for which are provided in the detailed caption of this episode. So, stay with me as Professor Doherty and Professor Hennefelt and I peel the history behind this news. I'm excited to share with you the news that later this month we will launch Unraveling the Middle East. It's a whole new weekly podcast, a series on the Middle East, its in-depth history and analysis. For example, one economic historian will answer this question: why Middle East economies and military technologies fell behind Europe's? In another episode, a U.S. military veteran and foreign policy scholar will tell us how the Vietnam War and later the fall of the Shah of Iran changed our military strategy and involvement in the Middle East. In yet another episode, we'll look at how theology affected intellectuals in the Middle East, particularly in their outlook on the tumultuous history of the 20th century. I've dropped a link to Unraveling the Middle East in the detailed caption of this episode, so you can follow this program on your favorite podcast platforms. Now, let's get back to our conversation with Professor Doherty and Professor Hennefelt about femme fatales, female villains, and nasty women who defy Hollywood stereotypes.
Professor Doherty and Professor Hennefeld, it's a pleasure to have you on our program. Professor Doherty, welcome back. Thank you both for taking the time for this conversation with me. So are there or were there stereotypical roles for Hollywood actresses?
Can I jump in?
Sure, please.
There are nothing but stereotypical roles for Hollywood actresses. I think the structure of Hollywood narrative really thrives on stereotypes, and the sort of mild digressions are more interesting. So basically we have like the damsel in distress and the other woman, or some kind of archetype of a good woman who's desirable. She'll raise your kids. She'll take care of your home, right? A nice normative lady versus whatever stands in opposition to that. The nymphomaniac, the single white female, the evil stepmother. I mean, Hollywood just keeps recycling different permutations of the good woman versus bad woman archetype. But I think the variance or room for play is really interesting, like the Spitfire in early 1930s screwball comedy, or the femme fatale in film noir, which I'm sure we can get into and talk about a little bit more through the conversation. I don't know. What do you think are the most interesting stereotypes, Tom?
I kind of agree with, the way you've set it up. And especially the there's this big, dividing line between what we call pre-code Hollywood femininity, or at least portraits of women from, say, 1930, 1934 is what I really think is, the kind of the sweet spot of pre-code. Some people backdate it to like 27 or so. And, I won't bring you up in charges if you want to do that. But I think one thing that's always very interesting about the pre-code era from 30 to 34, we tend to talk a lot about like sex because it's always interesting, and characters like Mae West or Barbara Stanwyck in Babyface, or Jean Harlow in Redheaded Woman, the kind of unapologetically sexual female portraits who are delicious, and there's a real attraction to these women on the internet. They have an amazing fan base on film Twitter, and those women. One of the things I also find so interesting about the pre-code portraitures is the political angle and the kind of the desperation you see in pre-code Hollywood women, like Loretta Young in Employee's Entrance, a kind of a figure who is usually very, the perfect gal, very sweet, off-screen, devout Roman Catholic. And even Loretta Young has to kind of barter her virtue to get a job. And that's something I think is very distinct to pre-code, where women are in
that
a
was
kind
a
of
movie? Economic.
Yeah, yeah. And it's called Employee's Entrance. It's a very fascinating film in which everybody's favorite pre-code scoundrel, an actor named Warren William, is managing this department store in the most ruthless, malicious way to keep the department store going. And he has basically a stable of models and shop girls that in order to get their job, they have to service Warren Williams. Some of it happens on off screen, of course, but a lot of it is absolutely explicit. Like, he says to one girl when she walks in, I didn't recognize you with your clothes on, which is the kind of line that you could only get away with in pre-code Hollywood cinema. But there's this whole group of films where the women are desperate enough that they have to take chances with their virtue, as it would have been called in the early 1930s. And then after 1934, that's not nearly as, this figure of the female negotiating sexuality reluctantly does not appear as prominently, because, of course, the production code, when it comes in 1934, begins regulating the kind of explicit narratives and explicit portraits that females can adopt. I don't know, Maggie.
Professor Doherty, I actually had a comment and a follow-up question before Professor Hennefeld shares her thoughts. My comment, as you were talking about the movie in which this woman sells her virtue to get an acting job.
Well, there are a lot of them, but the one I was talking about was Employee's Entrance. And
it almost reminds me, or makes me think of the Me Too movement in Hollywood, where women were forced to have sexual relationships with executive producers in Hollywood. And this is, now you're talking about the 1930s. So that's my comment with regards to that. My question was, in our last conversation,
pre-code does not mean pre-casting couch.
Yeah.
Right? These coercive dynamics between like actresses and producers were still like raging behind the scenes. It just regards the depiction of more explicit and transgressive sexuality in the stories that were being told.
So but I'm just so amazed. That's so progressive. This is, this movie was in the 1930s, right?
Yeah, 1932. Yeah.
And when we talk about pre-code, this also reminds me of the conversation you and I had, Professor Doherty, in 2023, where we talked about your book, Pre-Code Hollywood, Sex, Immorality, and Insurrection in American Cinema, right? This follows that conversation.
Yeah, and I guess the thing that I always sort of emphasize, because the sex and the violence part is we always like that and it's visible on screen. But one of the things I found so interesting about the pre-code era, you know, those early years of the Great Depression, is that you also see this, you know, a political sense of the nation is on board, it's chaotic, capitalism is under threat. And the image that I kept seeing when I was looking at a whole slew of pre-code films, and I know Maggie has done this with the early silent cinema, is when you look at a whole bunch of this stuff, it's like these images come back to you at night sometimes. That and the recurrent image I would always come to me in pre-code Hollywood was people marching through the streets, sometimes literally bearing torches. Mobs descending on buildings or on banks, which gives you a real sense of the political disorientation of the time. So, another example of that might, and something we forget when we think of the movie King Kong, of course, we always think of Kong on the Empire State Building.
Yeah.
The setup for King Kong is to get Fay Wray to go on this, crazy expedition to look for this giant ape. She's a starving girl on the streets of New York, and she's reaching, symbolically enough, for an apple at a fruit stand. And the shopkeeper accuses her of trying to steal the apple, and she says, "No, I was just hungry." And then she faints into Carl Denham's arms, and he takes her out to the first good meal she's ever had, in the last couple of years. And what forces her to go on this expedition is she's hungry. And many of the women in, like Loretta Young in Employee's Entrance are, literally hungry. And if you think of a movie like It Happened One Night, right on the cusp of the code, one of the things about the Claudette Colbert rich, spoiled brat heiress is at the beginning of the film, she throws a full meal of, a steak and potatoes, on the stateroom floor of her yacht. And the rest of the film is basically going to humiliate her, or not humiliate her, but to show her what hunger really is. Because in 1933-34, much of the audience is experiencing real hunger. There's a lot of food.
The Great Depression.
In 1930s cinema, where the camera, will like pan a buffet of wonderful food. And you can just almost feel the audience salivating as they're watching that. So
movies were cheap.
What was that? I'm sorry.
I said movies were cheap, but there's so much more. I mean, there's so much in what you're saying, Tom, the ways in which these negotiations of female sexuality and screen are entangled with the dire conditions that the population is facing during the Great Depression and just the total collapse of American institutions. I didn't mean to cut you off, but like everything you said is provocative. So
Professor Hennefeld, we're going to get to the silent movie section, which you've worked on so much in the next segment. What I wanted to know from you, just your opinion, is this. Do you think that the codes that came in the early 1930s locked in women into stereotypical roles, or would that have happened regardless of the codes and the restrictions?
Well, it certainly didn't help. It made the rules tighten, right, around what you could get away with representing. So, for example, the codes, like pre-code is a little bit of a misleading title because it was a list of do's and don'ts that were very loosely enforced in the late 1920s and early 30s, and then pretty much like rigidly policed by 1934. So you see some really, really interesting examples kind of on the cusp of pre-code and code, like Tom mentioned Barbara Stanwyck in this incredible film Babyface that was released in 1933 with an alternate ending. So out of duress, Barbara Stanwyck plays a woman who basically sleeps her way to the top, right? And there are these amazing tracking shots of various like high rise, you know, corporate office towers as her sexuality becomes, you know, a kind of metaphor for her unrepressed ambition, right? It's what it's her will to power.
She ascends vertically through horizontal means.
It's a good way. Yeah. It's a fun way to put it. There's literally a scene that was censored from an alternative release version in which a Nietzschean cobbler like quotes Will to Power to Barbara Stanwyck's character Lily and says, "Use men. You have to use men." And that's precisely what she does. And her friendship with a Black woman in the film named Chico, who's always sort of singing the St. Louis blues, right, as Lily is about to, like, you know, have sex with various men.
Wow.
It becomes like a really explicit way of signaling what is not quite, what Hollywood is not quite able to depict, even in the early 30s, the actual scene of sexual encounter. But I think the racial, even though Chico's character is reduced to a kind of, Black pal, Black maid, somewhere between friendship and service stereotype, it is a little bit more risque and interesting than the types of roles that were open to Black women at the time. So we talk about the stereotypes that sort of hemmed in white femininity. We also need to think about the mammy character, the Jezebel, the maid, the inscrutable Asian character, like the kinds of roles that Anna May Wong was typically reduced to during the 30s, the dragon lady.
Yeah, I think.
And, you know, we still see that today in Hollywood film, the ways in which stereotypes are also heavily racialized.
I just wanted to confirm something. We've been talking about Hollywood. Did these sort of stereotypical roles also apply to, let's say, indie films and Broadway as well?
Well, there were so little indie films at the time. I'll just say, because Hollywood had an oligopoly, they controlled everything. They owned all the theaters. They controlled production and distribution. It was really hard to mount a serious competition. But I will say, there were like two female filmmakers in Hollywood at the time, Dorothy Arzner and Ida Lupino, but there was also Maya Deren, who was an independent filmmaker in 1943, made a really, really interesting feminist experimental film called Meshes of the Afternoon, in which she plays a woman who's haunted, who's followed by a hooded figure with a mirror for her face.
What year was that? You said
1943. But that was not, you know, Meshes of the Afternoon is not having a wide national release. So even while there's more action in experimental cinema, and Tom can speak to the Broadway and theater scene, it doesn't have the same kind of eyeballs as major Hollywood
Professor Doherty, were you going to make a comment about Broadway?
Broadway, because it had a smaller audience and allegedly a more sophisticated New York audience, can have a little bit more leeway in terms of what it can portray. So even, you know, like figures like Paul Robeson could appear as a powerful Black man in something like The Emperor Jones, which later becomes a movie that doesn't really get that kind of distribution that it might have. So the roles on stage could be a little bit more risque. So All God's Children Got Wings, the other Eugene O'Neill Robeson production, actually has a white woman kissing his hand, something that would have been absolutely forbidden under the Hollywood production.
What time frame was that? What era?
23-24 for the stage version.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. We'll be back after a short break to talk about Hollywood's nasty women. Back in the summer of 2023, when Hollywood actors and writers were on strike,
I spoke with Professor Doherty about the magic of Hollywood. He told me about a time when the experience of going to the movies was spellbinding. In those early days, people laughed hysterically at the movies and openly sobbed during the sad scenes. And in some movies, they wouldn't leave the theater until the projectionist played the movie for them again. And if you think Taylor Swift's popularity is big time, you should listen to Professor Doherty describe Chaplin's popularity, the movie's first major star, a man recognized around the world more than the Pope or any president or monarch. Professor Doherty also drew comparisons between how TV disrupted Hollywood in the 1950s and how artificial intelligence is disrupting it now. And he'll tell us which technological advent is a more serious threat to Hollywood and its actors and creators. I've dropped a link for you to my conversation with Professor Doherty in Season 3, Episode 29. Now, let's get back to our conversation with Professor Doherty and Professor Hennefelt about cinema's so-called nasty and creepy women. Professor Doherty, Professor Hennefelt, we discussed some of this in the last segment, but let's review it again, if we could, please. What are the different types of antagonistic roles for women in cinema?
The femme fatale, known during the silent era as the vamp. So vamp? The vampire.
Ah, okay.
Kind of iconized by Theda Bara.
All yes. Right.
In the U.S. context.
Near Dulce Goldstein, good Jewish girl from Cincinnati.
Yeah. But that's not what the public wanted for her.
No.
It's not what her fans demanded. But the femme fatale, at least in 40s Hollywood, is always sort of punished. She's killed off at the end or incarcerated or forced to atone for her sins. She never gets away with her good time.
Yeah.
What other roles? Dark, creepy, I don't know, drama, horror movies?
Yeah, the evil stepmother, the nymphomaniac, the single white female, the crazy ex-girlfriend, the other woman, any woman whose sexuality and desire and ambition poses a kind of inconvenience or conflict for the film's more normative protagonists, like the good girl, the girl next door, the good old boy. Whoever, she's the woman, the bad woman is what stands kind of in conflict with the good protagonist getting exactly what they want. But she also spices things up. She creates kind of difference and tension that drives the narrative forward.
You mentioned nymphomania a couple of times, and I'm wondering, is this just pre-code before 1930s, or is this something that continued through the, let's say, 50s, 60s, 70s?
I mean, think of like Basic Instinct or, you know, single white female. I think more like post-code altogether, like after Hollywood's move to the rating system. Hollywood films, indie films, now you can't even tell the difference between the two, like that maybe would be rated R or PG-13.
Or nymphomaniac has this really kind of extreme connotation. I think the characters that you see in the 40s, and especially when Maggie was talking about the femme fatale, all those great portraits of women. What defines the femme fatale is sexuality and intelligence. And that's why she's dangerous, because she knows that she has sexual power over men and has the intelligence to manipulate it. So a figure like Marilyn Monroe is, she had one femme fatale role, but it was just wrong for her in Niagara. Like the thing that's funny about Marilyn Monroe is that she doesn't know the discombobulating effect that she has on men, like in The 7 Year Itch. She's like, or in some like It Hot, you know, she's just totally unaware of what her effect is. And so she doesn't know how
unaware
to use
on
it.
Unaware on screen or in real life as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, like she always gets the fuzzy end of the lollipop, as she famously says in Some Like It Hot. And that's because she doesn't have the wherewithal or intelligence to know that she can use her, you know, sexual power to get ahead. Where a character like Jane Greer in Out of the Past, it was just on TCM last night, is devastatingly aware of what she, you know, how she can manipulate the men in her clutches. And typically what's, why these films come out in the post-war era when men, you know, have been away for 4 years, they come back and they find out that, you know, women have kind of managed to get on fairly well without them. And they're real sort of threats to men, to the man's sense of autonomy and power. And so these femme fatales will typically be cast opposite a really big, strong guy like Burt Lancaster or Robert Mitchum, who are still helpless, you know, before somebody like Jane Greer. You know, she's, you know, there's this tiny, beautiful creature, but it doesn't matter how big Robert Mitchum is. He's going to, fall for her and in the end come to his death because of her. So they're really projections of male anxiety, but also projections of the female power that the sexual woman who is smart enough to know the effect she has. This is how she gets her power. There's a wonderful line in The Big Sleep, the book, not the movie, where there are two sisters, Vivian and Carmen Sternwood. And Carmen Sternwood is just a sexual creature. And, you know, she wants to sit on Philip Marlowe's lap, and she's utterly obvious, and she's no threat to Philip Marlowe. But when he looks at Vivian Sternwood and sees, you know, the Lauren Bacall character, you know, his line is a good summation of the femme fatale in Hollywood cinema, which is, she was trouble, you know, and the reason she's trouble is she has the sex and the intelligence, and he's smart enough to know. Yeah.
I think you could make the case that Marilyn Monroe also has the intelligence. She just is playing the ingenue, right? You have, like, a lot of her intelligence comes through as innuendo. She doesn't instrumentalize her dangerous sexuality the way, I don't know, like Phyllis Dietrichson does in Double Indemnity, right? Like, she's not ruthlessly, but I think that, and there, I mean, part of the sort of Me Too ethos is going back through the Hollywood canon and revisiting some of these stereotypes and sort of complicating the way in which they were read or understood at audiences at the time.
But if you look at the 7-year itch, you know, when she puts her underwear in the freezer, you know, like, she, I think when she
says
that,
it's a great gag. It's an irresistible.
Yeah, it is. But what's great about it is she has no idea what she's the impact she has on the Tom Yule character, right?
Again, when you say she has no idea, is this on stage or also in your real life? Is she doing this for her?
The actress knows what she's doing, right? And like, what is in real life for the character?
Yeah.
And she does have a femme fatale role in a film called Niagara. But it's sort of totally all wrong because, you know, she's walking through parties and
beautiful
stuff. And you
color noir.
Rise up. What? What
is it?
Say?
Beautiful color noir. It was just.
Yeah.
Professor Hennefeld, let's go back in time a little bit. You have co-curated a 4-disc DVD Blu-ray set that is titled Cinema's First Nasty Women. And your first book is Specters of Slapstick and Silent Film Comedian. Mm-hmm. And your forthcoming book is Death by Laughter. I'm listing these, your projects, because I'm wondering, do these different projects present a theme or some commonality about the acting roles of women in the early decades of cinema? And it's not just Hollywood, it's the broader cinema, right?
Yeah, and it's pre-Hollywood. In fact, like, it's before the American film industry, which was originally based mostly on the East Coast, like New York and New Jersey, before the film industry moved out west and Hollywood really established itself as the dream factory that it became. The film industry was so experimental and so much more open to women. So a lot of my work is inspired by this project called the Women Film Pioneers Project. It's an online research database and website that tracks the ways in which women worked in positions of creative power at every level of the global silent film industry, and then were sort of squeezed out of their positions in Hollywood in the 1920s, especially as Hollywood had serious financial backing from Wall Street and increasingly modeled its own sort of hierarchies and power structure on the kind of bro finance culture of Wall Street. But before then, like in the 19-teens, there were dozens and dozens of powerful women directors working in Hollywood.
Wow.
The most famous of which is probably Lois Weber. And for people interested in women directors in early Hollywood, I highly recommend Shelley Stamp's book, Lois Weber in Early Hollywood. It's phenomenal. I mean, Weber was making films about like abortion, birth control, poverty, contraception, rape, and sexual violence. I mean, really films that I show her films like Shoes to my students about like a poor immigrant girl, a girl working in a department store who has to like sell her own sexuality to buy a new pair of shoes because the shoes that she has are falling apart and she's on her feet all day. And not just in Hollywood, around the world. I'd say you asked if there was a common theme in my own work.
Yeah.
Maybe nasty women, specters of slapstick, death by laughter. It reveals a kind of longstanding obsession with women's active roles in slapstick comedy and really like violent, rough and tumble knockabout slapstick comedy. As much as women and feminism are empowered through comedy today in 2024, it's more like stand-up and sketch comedy, or, you know, romantic comedy has always been a genre that's open to women's senses of humor, which are often like, you know, marginalized in other forms of comedy.
Yeah.
But women like so our DVD set, it's 99 films made between 1898 and 1926, mostly from North America and Western Europe, just because of the archives we were working in. But there were nasty women in the silent film industry all over the world. Our set focuses on slapstick comedies, you know, in which kitchen maids go on general strike, teenage miscreants electrocute police officers.
Oh, wow.
Woman desegregates white public spaces, including a police department, with her contagious laughter. An indigenous woman shoots up white cowboys in a saloon and lives to tell the tale after romantically pursuing a white man for the entirety of the film. So things that would have been not only transgressive, but strictly verboten in Hollywood by the rise of the talkies just ran rampant in the silent film industry.
Professor Hennefeld, you're talking about the 1890s, the aughts of 1900 and 1910s. Mm-hmm. Was there an audience for these films?
Was there? That's what, like, these films were made because that's what the audience demanded. I mean, before...
That's so crazy. You would think of early 1900s as us Americans, I guess people around the world, being more conservative. But the way you're telling it, that's not the case. Audience was welcoming this, was seeking these sort of films.
I mean, it was like today, the late 19th and early 20th century. It was a time of immense social change and mass anxiety about these changes, right? Like labor strikes, immigration, women demanding suffrage, equal rights, enfranchisement. I mean, there are a lot of social movements that that these representation, that these films were depicting, but also really fueling and energizing. So there were so many early comedies made about the suffragette movement and about like kitchen maids organizing labor strikes. And early cinemas, like, it wasn't a highbrow medium in the early aughts, right?
Yeah.
Like the main venue for cinema after, like, originally it was kind of itinerant, like films would show in vaudeville theaters or traveling shows, carnivals, even churches, community clubs. By 1905, that's the year of the Nickelodeon boom, when all of these sort of seedy storefront theaters in the US were established as venues for watching motion pictures, which could be as short as 20 seconds long and, you know, would play in loops. And these were like dens of vice. They were like, reformists were obsessed with cleaning up the Nickelodeons. You know, they were all like tinderboxes, fire safety hazards. People would go to like hook up and connoiter, or simply to get away from their conservative families. Like, a lot of early film audiences were women, working class people, immigrants. The kind of experience you would have at the movies would maybe depend on like the ethnic neighborhood you live in. The language that you would hear in a New York theater, you know, it might be Italian, it might be Yiddish, it might be German. It wasn't necessarily English, right? The language that people were speaking, you know, kind of in the peanut gallery. But yeah, it was like, this is like, women were early cinema's primary audience, and they wanted to see, you know, reflections of themselves raising utter hell and tearing down the world that was failing to offer them a satisfying place for their own desires.
This is so amazing, because For non-experts such as me, you would think that the 1960s and 1970s is when the cinema started to liberalize a little bit, but it actually was liberal socially and for women in its early history. So given this background, why do you think there is now a trend for women to play nasty roles again? When we started communicating about this episode, I sent both of you a Wall Street Journal article in which it was talking about a movie, May December, that's the title of the movie, with Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman. So, and there are many other movies that have been around for the last decade. Why do you think that's coming back now?
I mean, it's the zeitgeist. It's the ethos, right? Hashtag Me Too and Time's Up. It's a moment of popular feminist consciousness. I mean, Todd Haynes, the director of May December, which is a loose adaptation of this Mary Kay Letourneau tabloid scandal from the 90s, right? A middle school teacher who slept with and eventually married her 12-year-old student, or he wasn't 12 when they got married, but he was when she initially slept with
him.
I think it resonates with the zeitgeist, but some of my students are shocked to find out, that Promising Young Woman is like not, in fact, the first rape revenge nasty woman film that the U.S. industry has ever produced. There were a popular cycle of rape revenge comedies in the late 1890s, a few of which are included in cinema's first Nasty Woman, including Trouble with the Dairy Maid, where like this dude is molesting a dairy maid and she responds by taking her like bucket of freshly squeezed cow's milk and just dumping it over his head. So it's not quite as elaborate as Promising Young Woman, but I think there's also a turn to the archive, right? In tandem with giving women these sort of like nasty transgressive roles today, I think there's also a popular will to dig up the history of how these kinds of representations have existed for quite a long time.
I see. We'll be back after a short break to talk about empowered women and why do we call them actresses anyway? We'll be right back.
We hope you are enjoying this podcast. And if you are, then why not treat us to a cup of coffee? That's right. For the price of a cup of coffee, you too can become a monthly supporter of the History Behind News podcast. We rely on your support to continue this program, to continue peeling the history behind our news. Supporting us is easy. Just click the support link in the detailed caption of this episode. And while you're there, check out the information about our guests and other attributions and links. And thank you.
Professor Doherty, during the break, you were commenting on Professor Hennefeld's work. I'd love for you to share that with our audience, please.
Well, one of the the great things for me, because this is not my area of expertise, but anybody interested in film is sort of interested in the whole gamut, even though you can't be, you usually segment off your own chapter of expertise in film history. And, one of the things that's been so enlightening about the work that Maggie has done, and she mentioned another colleague scholar in this area, Shelley Stamp, who's kind of rediscovered this extraordinary female filmmaker named Lois Weber, who, the same year that D.W. Griffith is making Birth of a Nation, which is the landmark we all remember, she's making the film that Maggie mentioned called Shoes. And, the thing that's so great about Weber and some of these other, forgotten figures is it isn't just the narratives that you find interesting, but it's the cinematic artistry that she's bringing to these roles. So Shoes isn't just like a polemic about a woman who's, an oppressed working class woman who needs to barter herself in order to get a new pair of shoes. But a remarkably creative a work of cinema where you have these tracking shots of her feet walking. You have sort of multiple exposures. These figures, you wonder how we could not have known them better, and whether they're forgotten because of men collect the archives, men write the histories traditionally, or whether some people just get fall through the cracks. So there are these whole traditions now that we're rediscovering, and there's always a race against time to make sure that you actually can obtain the celluloid. I'm sure that Maggie's had some of the same experiences I've had, as where you research something and the first place you go typically, if you're an historian, is the motion picture trade press. And that's just the fancy name for the journals and, you know, and the magazines that Hollywood used to talk to themselves about motion pictures. So you read an account of this extraordinary film, and you go, I got to see that. And you can't see it because it's what we call lost in the business, or my film archivist.
Over 80% of all silent films ever made are lost. It's
right.
So
yeah.
Sad.
What do you mean they're lost? I don't follow that.
No longer exist. Like nitrate it has to be stored at the proper temperature, or else it will like go up in flames or disintegrate into dust. And oftentimes, nitrate prints were just scrapped for the silver content because it was more expensive to preserve them than just to get rid of them, or they were dumped in the ocean.
I know this is going to be a naive question, but this is not something that the Library of Congress stored, archived, or anything like that. It never got to that level.
We weren't interested in that in America for a long time. Like the big landmark is the Museum of Modern Art established a film division in the 1930s. And there was a really terrific archivist named Iris Berry who started systematically collecting stuff. The European tradition, both the Germans and the French, and, you know, Maggie, correct me if I'm wrong, because you know more about this stuff, tended to be more tenacious in preserving their motion picture legacy, where the Library of Congress for a long time just didn't want to get involved. They had a copyright office, but mm-hmm. the systematic, careful preservation mm-hmm. of what we consider the great art of the 20th century, motion pictures, was not really something that a lot of museums, archives, libraries were interested in. So it's catch as catch can. It's dumb luck. Everybody has the fantastic stories about, you know, going into the attic after grandpa dies and finding 16 millimeter prints, if you're lucky.
That's such a loss. That's unfortunate.
In an old barn.
It's a scavenger hunt.
Yeah. And a lot, because silent films were circulating and screening all over the world, sometimes a lost Hollywood film will turn up in the Czech Republic or in the Netherlands.
Spain. We prefer the circumlocution "not yet found," right, in the archive business.
Like the 97% of Indian silent films ever made are not yet found, right? Like,
could I ask Maggie a question? I don't know if I've ever asked you this, Maggie. What's your sort of holy grail of a lost nasty woman film that you've read about?
Oh, what a great question.
And that you're really salivating at the mouth to see, but you haven't located.
The Kitchen Maid's Dream. It's a Vitagraph film from 1907 about a kitchen maid who falls asleep and has a vivid dream. So the film uses object animation. She dreams that she dismembers her limbs. So her hands and feet do the rest of her housework for her, while her supine body, you know, kind of like catches up on rest. But I want to know what that looked like. Like, do you actually see her body without limbs? I don't know. There's another
especially with that
film
technology
about
back
armless,
then.
What's that?
Especially with that technology back then, how do they do that?
Oh, well, it's just object animation, frame by frame animation, which they could integrate with live action. And that was pretty common actually with the French Pathé Company and the American Vitagraph Company specialized in those sorts of trick films in the aughts and teens.
Professor really, Hennefeld, really what, cool is what is Vitagraph?
It was an early filmmaking company based in Brooklyn, their old studio. And it was eventually absorbed by Warner Brothers in the 1920s.
Yeah. It was established by this really this fascinating lost to cinema guy named J. Stuart Blackton, who is one of the original motion picture pioneers. He was such a pioneer that he knew Edison. And he got into the big. He was a vaudeville performer and a cartoonist, and also a reporter. And his newspaper sent him out to interview Edison in 1898, I think. And Edison was so impressed, he kind of offered the guy a job. And then he establishes his own company and makes films throughout the teens and the 20s, and eventually, like so many of these guys, goes bust. I think he didn't want to move out to Hollywood. He spent a lot of money. He had a real affinity for emeralds and yachts and
don't we all?
yes, exactly. And my film, since you didn't ask, that I want to see, and I've been interested in this Blackton character, is he makes a film in 1915, which I believe is the first dystopic invasion film, like a huge motion picture of what would happen if America were invaded, and it's apparently lost. So
Battle Cry of Peace, is that?
Yeah.
And 1915, so that's within a year of World War One.
It's during World War One, and it's actually like in some ways like Birth of a Nation. It's a warning to America about the dangers of getting into another war. We look at Birth of a Nation today, we're of course obsessed with the racial politics, but at the time it was kind of viewed as an anti-war film as well, because Europe of course is at war, and we're not going to enter the war until 1917.
Professor Vanderfeld, I want to go
more of the anti-war film, the pacifist follow-up to Birth of a Nation. I heard a rumor that there's a surviving fragment from Battle Cry of Peace. Sorry, this is getting super
really
maybe at the George Eastman Museum. Someone told me that it might have been Peter Bagraw. Anyway, this is far from Hollywood actress stereotypes.
I know. Let me wheel this back in. Professor Hennefeld, I want to
this will happen when you talk to film geeks, by the way.
No, I love it. Let me ask you, Professor Hennefeld, about a phrase that you used, damsel in distress. You said that in the first segment of our conversation. And I want to make sure I articulate this question correctly. Do you think antagonistic roles are liberating for women? And let me explain what I mean by that. I've been thinking about this question last night. So these roles, these sort of nasty roles, show women, from my perspective, as complex beings. Some are good, some are bad, some are morally compromised, just like men. They have their own agency. Mm-hmm. Does that show equality? Does that show empowerment?
Yeah, I mean, it depends. It depends on the particular role and how it's handled, right? Like, there have been antagonistic roles for women, right, as the villain. We've already kind of trotted out a lot of these archetypes throughout the history of Hollywood. I think there's a distinction to be made between antagonist and anti-hero. Anti-hero is sort of like the villain that you identify with in spite of yourself, and it's a much meatier role for the actor, right? So maybe, I don't know if I see like Julianne Moore's role in May December in the same vein as, say, like classic anti-heroes of American cinema, like Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver, or, you know, Patrick Bateman in American Psycho. But Lydia Tarr is maybe a better example. And that was something that another kind of flashpoint that was mentioned in that Wall Street Journal article that you shared with us.
Yeah.
Right. Like a distinctly unlikable but complex character. And I think, like you said, it's not that the character itself, it's not that like watching Lydia Tarr like will lead to feminist liberation, but it is a sign of a kind of public appetite for more nuance in terms of the types of roles that are available to women in popular cinema, and probably a much more interesting part to play for Cate Blanchett than, I don't know. Well, she has a good track record on that front because she's such a big celebrity. She can do whatever she wants. But I think
actresses will always tell you that they'd rather play the bitches than the good girl. Not only do they get more screen time, they're kind of more interesting, like you say, interesting characters. They're complex. They can play two characters. Like, you know, I always love that line in Double Indemnity where Barbara Stanwyck first walks down after, you know, she comes out to greet the unknown male visitor in her bathrobe or in the bath towel. And then when she walks back down, she says, "Do I have my face on right?" And that, you know, that's a signal that like this is a woman that has many faces. So of course, we'll tend to really embrace those roles rather than the sort of the boring good girls.
And in films made by women, I mean, I think you find more, even more of these sort of complex, empowered female characters, like both, you know, Tar and May December were, they're really interesting films. They're directed by men. I mean, I think if you look at a film like Jean Dielman, made by Chantal Ackerman in 1975, which in the recent British Film Institute Sight and Sound poll was voted by like however many hundred critics, scholars, filmmakers as the greatest film of all time. Jean Dielman, you know, by people who know about these things, has been decided the greatest film of all time. It's over 3.5 hours long.
Oh, wow.
It's an experimental film about...
You want to know how to bake potatoes. It's a great
film. Yeah, they're like, yeah. Like a 15-minute scene of a woman just sort of like sitting in front of the camera, peeling potatoes, pounding veal, but she's also a sex worker. And like, that's how she, you know, like raises her son. And the film takes a very different turn in the last act. I don't want to spoil anyone who's like planning to watch the first 2 hours and 45 minutes before this twist is revealed.
2 hours and 45 minutes. I love it. Let me ask this question in the minute we have left of this segment. Professor Doherty just used the term actress several times. Why actress? We don't, you know, if a woman is a doctor, we call her just doctor, physician, professor, lawyer, accountant, astronaut. We don't assign gender to their profession. Professor Hennefeld, I call you professor or doctor. There's no gender. Why do we do that with actresses? Why can't we just call them actors? It's not a statement. I'm not trying to advocate anything. I'm wondering where that came from.
Well, I would say it's because casting matters, right? And what, of course, the modern political person would call the gender binary is just you know, so embedded in our drama, in our narrative. So if I'm doing a remake of Double Indemnity and I do a casting call, presumably I don't want two men to play, you know, the roles of the insurance agent and the housewife.
If I'm doing I'm here a for a gay Double Indemnity.
Yeah, say that again, please. Say that again.
I'm here for a queer reboot of Double Indemnity. I think that would be
fun. Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. Oh,
also,
of course.
It's like, it's lucrative for Hollywood to have these categories. I mean, think of like the best actor, best actress Oscar. I mean, like stardom and celebrity are an industry. This is like Hollywood's bread and butter. And these gender distinctions are really operative in and like the Hollywood cult of celebrity and how Hollywood valorizes and markets its own product.
So is there a movement to get rid of the term actress, or are female actors okay with that?
There's a political movement to get rid of it. My sense is, you know, beyond under the realm of public discourse, that people don't want to change it because it alienates so much of the audience. And also because if you've got, say, a category for the 10 best actors, which would include male and female in any given year, then you might have, say, 7 males and 3 females one year, or vice versa. I think there's a sense that 5 and 5, you know, works in those categories.
I see.
Maggie, maybe you dissent.
Can I say really quickly? I mean, and again, you have to go back to the pre-Hollywood days, like. Film actors weren't even known by name or kind of like marketed as celebrities, publicized by their like name and reputation until the late 1900s and early 10s. And before that time, it was typical for women to play boy characters or male characters. Like there's a film called The Girl Detective where, called The Boy Detective, where the boy detective is played by a woman. We don't know the name of this actor, but she's revealed in the final close-up as a woman. But during the entirety of the film, you don't know the actor's gender. And often, you know, like sort of poaching terms from theater, motion picture actors were referred to as players at the time, which is, you know, like less specifically gendered. But Edna Billy Foster, for example, whose films we've like collected in Cinema's First Nasty Woman, she basically only played boy characters for the Biograph company. That was her preference.
Well, yeah, but you mentioned Biograph, of course. Very quickly, audiences learned to identify some of the characters they liked, most famously with the Biograph girl, which was the name for the, as Maggie notes, you know, the what today we call stars weren't billed. But audiences started coming up to the Nickelodeons and saying, you know, I want to see a film with the Biograph girl. And that was Florence Lawrence, who is usually valorized as the first, you know, name brand motion picture star. And that became, you know, whether it was organic from the audience or whether it was a marketing technique from the producer, very quickly we started going to movies to see our favorite screen personality, a face. And it's probably not coincidental that many of those people were females. You know, producers will usually tell you that, like, you know, there are two audiences that are interested in looking at attractive women on screen, and one is males and the other is females. And so that's always a good way to kind of market your film. When we think of breakout performances, we often think of a female who's, you know, eyes that you can't, you know, you can't take your eyes off a certain visage. There's a Saul Guvertel, the diarist, memoirist in Hollywood, just screenwriter, actresses, has a wonderful memoir in which she talks about seeing Greta Garbo on screen in a Berlin theater in 1925. And it's the first time you see Garbo in close up. And she says, when you see, you know, when her face came on the screen, the audience gasped. You know, and that's sort of what a great, beautiful female star can do for your film. And I think we can all think of films where you're kind of following a performance. And often for me, and maybe this is gendered, it's like, you know, when I look at Out of the Past, I'm not looking at Robert Mitchum, you know, even though I like his performance, right? You're looking at this, you know, a beautiful female character who's also portraying a character. So I think Hollywood would be making a big marketing mistake if it got rid of those categories. And I think there was a moment about a couple of years ago where they were contemplating it. And now
marketing categories are going anywhere, but what about like non-binary actors, for example, like which?
Yeah, see, that's I mean, first of all, how many of them are there? You know, what are you going to do with them?
Yeah.
You know, whether there'd be, you know, a special category doesn't seem correct, but, you know, I think my sense is, as I was saying, is a couple years ago, this was very much in the discourse with the Academy.
I recall that. Yeah. It was in the journal
as
well.
Now my sense is they sort of don't want to go there because the Oscars are losing ratings anyway.
Yeah. Let's take a break here.
Maggie, what's your sense?
Hollywood is not at the vanguard of gender liberation in terms of cultural representation. Let's just leave it at that.
Let's take a break here. Stay with me and Professor Doherty and Professor Hennefelt as we get into the perspective.
The History Behind News podcast is available on all your favorite podcast platforms. Of course, we love your reviews and ratings of our podcast, especially on Apple and Spotify. And remember, don't keep us to yourself. Tell a friend about the History Behind News podcast.
Professor Doherty, if you wanted our audience to remember just one point about women in Hollywood, what would it be?
That they're the on screen, they're almost always the dominant driving force. And then, as people like Maggie and Shelley Stamp have demonstrated to us, behind the camera as well, there's a tradition of contribution and artistry, you know, pioneering work by all these women that we've forgotten. And I think when we sort of look at the screen, we might be also thinking that there's this entire tradition behind the screen that we've forgotten, women, producers, directors, cinematographers, editors. Editors was, you know, one of the places women could really get their foot in the door, ironically, because of a stereotype that editing film together is like stitching. So the traditional female skills of the seamstress would adapt very well to editing. So Dorothy Arzner,
known as cutters at the time.
Right. And Dorothy Arzner, a director, really.
They were literally cutting film reels. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah. When you cut and splice, that's how editing was done back in the day before editing.
Before
system.
Software. You tell students like this, it's like, you know, it's like the antiquarian, you know, illuminated manuscripts. But that's the way a lot of women would get their foot in the door. And achieve, even if they didn't become directors, achieve a lot of influence. So famously, Bobby Allen at Fox was basically Daryl Zanuck's right-hand woman, and she was the the person in the studio whose opinion he most respected. So the work of Maggie and Shelley Stamp and other film historians, I think, have really opened my eyes to that behind the scenes.
Professor Hennefeld, if you wanted our audience to remember just one point about women in Hollywood, what would it be?
That there are more interesting depictions of women in film outside of Hollywood.
I love that. Professor Doherty and Professor Hennefeld, thank you so much for educating me and our listeners. And to our listeners, if you know of any history that could provide more perspective from the past on this subject, please share it with us and tell us what's your perspective. Thank you so very much to the both of you.
Thank you.
The opinions and statements of our guests are their own. We neither agree nor disagree with them. We're only interested in the perspective they provide through history. At History Behind News, we're honored that our guests share their expertise with us, most of which are based on years of scholarship and research, and we provide links to their projects and publications for your benefit to review them if you wish. Otherwise, we're not affiliated with our guests. We just think they teach us pretty cool history, the history behind our news. Also, unless we explicitly inform you, we're not affiliated with any institutions, including Amazon, for which book links are shared here from time to time for your convenience. Finally, as a reminder, we don't do news here at History Behind News. We peel the news for the history behind it. And our mission is not to provide a complete account and analysis of the past. Rather, is to highlight some issues and incidents in our history that may poke and prod your discerning minds into seeking some perspective for our news. And if you disagree with our take on history, well then, it means we've succeeded in getting you to think about the history behind news. And of course, share your thoughts with me by leaving your comments on Twitter or sending an email to adele@historybehindnews.com. I love to hear from you. I love to learn from you. Until next time, this is Adele with History Behind News, a history podcast for our news.